I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, the history and evolution of music. From our earliest ancestors to Mozart, jazz, and hip-hop, technology has always had an impact on the art.
The first bone flutes 40,000 years ago were so revolutionary because with a tool, you abstract notes from the voice. The voice is the most natural organ to produce sound. A flute is not. A flute is a piece of technology.
And later, the effects of music on the brain. New research provides some clues on how our brains process music and rhythms.
Music can modulate brain activity, and in certain settings, not curative, can be very helpful, at least for compensating or diverting, or in some cases, enhancing function.
Humans and our deep and unique relationship to music. All ahead on Life Examined. You probably can't remember the first time you heard music. Perhaps it was a nursery rhyme, a church choir, or a ringtone. Sounds and rhythms are such an intrinsic part of our lives, it's hard to imagine a world without music. So at what point did our ancestors first become musical, and why? While it's hard to pinpoint the evolution of human song, the discovery of a 40,000-year-old bone flute in a German cave showed that hominids, our prehistoric ancestors, used a tool to produce sounds. Fast forward thousands of years, music has played an important role in cultures all across the globe. But much of our musical inspiration comes from the rhythms of life, from natural sounds around us, and from the rhythmic sounds we make each day, sometimes just placing one foot in front of the other. Professor of Music Michael Spitzer describes music as, quote, our umbilical cord to Mother Nature, and that we're all innately musical, even if we think we can't play a tune. His latest book is called The Musical Human, A History of Life on Earth, and he joins me now. Michael Spitzer, welcome to Life Examined.
It's my pleasure.
Let's go far, far back in time and talk about where we first may see signs of music. And I sense it may not be in humans, but in animals. So where does this story begin?
Well, my book is an origin story and a history of the world. A very simple answer to where music begins, it's in animals, because birds sing and whales sing. And we descended, we evolved along the ape line. And somewhere between 8 million years ago, the date of the missing link between non-human primates and us, we began to evolve. So sometime between 8 million years and about 40,000 years ago, when we discovered the first bone flutes, which is a sign of musical technology, animal vocalization evolved into human song.
And the sounds we hear in nature, even today, would that be what we heard those thousands of years ago as well?
I think so. Birds and whales wouldn't have evolved that much. And we know through technology such as spectrographs, which allow us to analyze the acoustic structure of bird songs and humpback whale songs, they're very similar to what we call music. Birds and whales essentially improvise on templates, on patterns, in a similar way to jazz musicians. They are creative. They have what biologists call vocal learning. They're able to, not just to receive or to inherit the songs their parents taught them, but they can create new songs. Not many animals can do that, but birds can do it. Whales can do it, bats can do it, and we can do it.
And for these incredible creatures and animals, what was the purpose of their song, do you think?
A similar purpose to the way we use music. So birds and whales use song to attract a mate, and Darwin called that sexual selection. They also use music to deter rivals, to establish a home or a territory, and to define who they are, their identity.
So as we think about the first sounds that humans made, talk to me about those. You talked about a little bit about the remnants of bone flutes, and I'd imagine singing was a very big part too.
It was. We have to be careful. We have a word called music, and outside the West, across the world, cultures don't use a single word to define all the very complex things that what we call music does. Somewhere along the line, music crystallizes out of many different things, essentially a kind of organized sound. If you look at how vervet monkeys use their calls, their vocalization, they use an alarm call to signal different kinds of predator. So a different call would alert their colleagues that there's a snake or there's a leopard or there's an eagle. And these sounds have functions. They do something. They're not exactly a language because there's no syntax. They can't combine different calls to make a more complex call, as we use language to. But what song does is it plays with sound and uproots these sounds from having any function. So gradually, primates and hominids, which are our ancestors, they start to take vocalizations and enjoy them for pleasure. And this happens once the larynx, our vocal organ, starts to descend and enables our ancestors to make a far richer variety of sound. In fact, more sound than they have need for. There's an excess of sound, and so they can start using the sound just for pleasure. Mm. So music as an art form means that we enjoy sound for sound's sake. It doesn't have an obvious or a direct function. And that happens when there's an excess of sound. The variety of sound exceeds the function of sound. Now, the second step happens when you start to create tools like flutes to make sound. Why is that so important? Well, the first bone flutes 40,000 years ago were so revolutionary because with a tool, you abstract notes from the voice. The voice is the most natural organ to produce sound. A flute is not. A flute is a piece of technology. And what's extraordinary about a bone flute is that Homo sapiens managed to combine two distinct parts of the human brain, the part which is responsible for making tools or technology, and the part which expresses emotion or music. And arguably, Neanderthals who came before us couldn't do that. They couldn't cross between these two parts of the brain. And what defines the greater plasticity of the human brain is the ability to make these connections between technology and song. What a flute is, it's a tool which makes song.
That's amazing because, yeah, you're talking about humans evolving and music evolving at the same time. Aspects of our biology are changing, aspects of our brain, plasticity of the brain changing. And so it's a parallel story in many ways, isn't it?
It is, but we haven't lost these parts of our brain. Our brain is a palimpsest or a multi-layered sandwich. And we still have the brain stem. And we still have the reptile brain, and we have the amygdala, or the mammal brain. On top of that, we have the neocortex. Now, what's remarkable about music is that it engages all four layers of the brain. So when you hear a shock or a loud bang, and a lot of music, think of Haydn, the Surprise Symphony with a loud bang, that trips the startle reflex, and it engages the most fundamental and primitive part of the brain, the brainstem. This is what simple organisms flinch to. Mm. They flinch to sound. The reptile brain, in our brain, it enjoys pleasure or displeasure. The mammalian amygdala experiences emotions. And the topmost layer, the neocortex, the most complex, it responds to patterns or to musical logic. Now, the same kind of music can engage all four layers of sound. So in a way, when you're listening to music, you're time traveling. You're going back. It's an umbilical cord back to Mother Nature. It takes us back, and we're speaking in a way to when we were mammals, when we were fish, when we were just simple organisms. And only music can do that. No other art form can engage different levels or parameters of evolution, the same way that music can.
That image there, the umbilical cord back into where we come from, back into nature, really strikes me. because, I mean, it makes me again think about what music is, the origins of it, the melody meeting rhythm, again, pattern versus kind of embellishment, all of these things. And are we still in many ways replicating what we hear around us? Or I know it's evolved some since then, but that's kind of the image I was following as you were talking.
We are. Once we get into recorded human history or civilization, the last 40,000 years, then the development of music really accelerates and it goes its own way. So there's out of Africa moment where sapiens migrate out of East Africa and they go through Europe and Asia and Australia and then the circumpolar regions and they go to North America and then through down to South America. Music is so plastic in some ways as sticky as the brain is, and wherever it goes, it changes. And this is why, although music is a universal phenomenon, that is to say, every culture in the planet has what it calls music. Mm-hmm. It's always different. It's always different. So my book traces the history of the world by going through music in China, in India, in parts of Africa, of course, in the West. Yeah. It tries to explain why, despite its variety, Western music went viral and dominates the planet through globalization. A little bit like English or Shakespeare or the English language or technology or capitalism.
You also write about the importance of song between a mother and a child, which I found fairly touching. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yes, just as music predates language in evolution by billions of years, it also comes before language in human development. So long before language comes in a child's development, when they're toddlers or a little bit older, preschool, they're effectively communicating with their mother through infant-directed speech or motherese or proto-conversations. Just look at the way a mother or any caregiver plays with their child. They have processes of turn-taking or imitating each other or surprising each other. It's a dialogue and it's completely social and it's musical. And in places, all the dynamics which you see in a jazz improvisation or in a string quartet, so that the way musicians turn-take or imitate each other or play with each other, it's a very social phenomenon. It's already in place in a dialogue between a mother and a child, which means that music is always profoundly social. It's never alone. It's always between people.
Mm. That's another, I think, really important point that you write about, which is that the origins of early music are ones that are shared with a community, with a family, with friends. Isn't that right as well?
You can go even further than that and say that music is the most important thing we ever did because it's music which fostered human society. It stretched social relationships. If you look at the way that chimpanzees groom each other through touch, if you groom each other through sound, you can groom a far bigger group of people. Don't need to be in immediate proximity to somebody you're talking to. So the role of music is to touch a group of people, using the word touch metaphorically. And once that's in place, you can use music to coordinate work, that you can work in rhythm with each other. And through sharing sound, you can share feelings and a state of mind, what linguists call a theory of mind. You can sense what somebody's thinking by the way they sound, the way they communicate with you. And this is why human society evolved, arguably through sharing sound with each other.
Can you talk a little bit about rhythm, which is something that it is, of course, musical, but I've never fully understood it, why it is so important to humans. And of course, it is fundamental. Say a little bit about that, if you would.
We aren't the only species to feel rhythm. Insects do it. Katydids or bush crickets can pulse in regular time in massed choruses. Interestingly, birds can't do it, with the exception of a cockatoo called Snowball, who can boogie to the sound of pop songs, the Backstreet Boys, for example. Apes have no rhythm. They can't sing either. But humans were the great synthesizer. They could bring all these things together, rhythm and vocal learning and the gestures of apes. Rhythm is organization. And when I say that music didn't crystallize until quite recently, what we call music, an aspect of that was the rhythm of life. So all the routines which organize life, you have habits, comings and goings, the way you walk, that's rhythm. Getting up on your feet, and the first hominins, the Australopithecines, like Lucy and Ardy 4 million years ago, it was so important to start walking upright because the regularity of footfalls, that establishes, it forges links between the brain and muscular exertion and indeed sound. And not just that, but also a sense of time, because once you have a pattern of footfalls, you can predict what will happen next. And that sets in place a really important ingredient of human music, and which is why our music is haunted by the rhythm of walking. Now, we hear walking in all human music. So you could argue that rhythm is all-encompassing because life is all about routine and regularity and work. Even turn-taking when you have a conversation, that's a kind of rhythm. Even thinking about things in your mind when you're rehearsing memory, you're repeating it in your mind. That's a kind of rhythm. And all these things crystallize into what we call music a lot later downstream.
It's that's a fascinating point. I mean, thinking about rhythm in this much more abstract sense as being present all around us, even when we're not really aware of it. And you even talked about earlier aspects of the brain that are seeking pattern, always looking for patterns in the world, which is, I think, something that also makes sense to me when we talk about the nature of rhythm.
Yes. And it works both ways, because when we walk around a city wearing our earbuds and listen to our favorite songs, we're imposing the rhythm of the track or the song onto the rhythm of city life around us. We're musicalizing the city, making a personal soundtrack, like being in our own movie. So we're imposing our own rhythm back onto the world where rhythm originally came from. And this is how film music operates.
Well, I think this brings us to an important point, which is when we first begin to see traces of musical notation and how this changes what music was before. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. The story begins about 1,000 years ago with a monk in Italy called Guido d'Arezzo. And he invents what we call staff notation. That's, you know, putting five lines on the page and plotting dots to create a score. And in a sense, it's like a book. He turns music into a literate culture. And there are swings and roundabouts or mods and cons to it. It's incredibly useful because it helps the church to regulate Christianity or Christendom. So if you want to know what the monks are singing at the far corners of the empire, say where I come from, which is Northern England, you don't have to send soldiers out there because you can guarantee they literally sing from the same hymn sheet as the monks in Rome.
Right.
The problem is that you're turning music into an object. And music isn't an object. Music is an activity like dancing or running or speaking. And it's artificial to think that music can be imprisoned on the page, like pinning a butterfly to a wall, I like to call it. And that commits the West into a very strange relationship to music, where music is on the page. And what musicians do is mechanically reproduce it by performing it. And that drives a wedge between the music and the performer. And you don't get that distinction in many parts of the world, which are based on improvisation or creative improvisation. So if we turn to India, Hindustani or Carnatic oral traditions, they don't, as a rule, think of the music as something you notate as a piece or a work, as an object. And music is a creative act of of improvisation. It's different every time you perform it. You don't freeze it. So we had this canon or museum of symphonies or sonatas by Mozart and Beethoven and Bach. They're eternal. They're frozen, and music becomes rather artificial. Mm. It's all about heritage, and it saps the vitality, you could say, out of our tradition. I'm not talking, of course, about jazz or about folk or about trad or many of the surviving oral traditions in the West. I'm talking about the split between the oral and the so-called classical traditions.
And it makes me think, I mean, in that tradition that you're talking about, how music can become, in some cases, elitist, or the idea of going to the concert hall, right, where there is the separation between the performer and the listener. It's not an integrative or communal act anymore.
It's not. And given, as I argue, that music is innate, babies are born musical, nearly everybody is musical, it's universal. It's bizarre that in the West, we have these things called musicians, or indeed musical geniuses. Right. So paradoxically, I think the future lies in taking music away from musicians, and giving it back to people.
I wanted to share with you and our listeners, I mean, as a musician myself, I lived in Kentucky for years. This is one of the last places where traditional music is still passed on simply by memory. And there, you know, you would have the traditional jam sessions, as much like you might see in England or Ireland, and people would simply just show up with their instruments and begin to play by the songs that have been passed down by generations. And I would join in, and I remember distinctly what a different feeling that is than one gets from what we have just been talking about, the differentiation between the musician and the listener. And it almost felt as if we were calling back upon earlier forms of being human or community or tribe. I think that's kind of what we're talking about here, is more of that tradition or style of music, which I think resonates a lot more with people, no?
Yes, it's a participatory culture of music, where anybody can join in at whatever level they're capable of performing. So it's very accommodating to the most skilled and the less skilled. And originally, I think all music was like that. And in large parts of the world, I talk in the book about the Venda peoples of Limpopo in South Africa, where there's an assumption that everybody joins in the dance.
I wonder for you if there are other ways that you think that kind of music needs to be taken out of the prison that it's in and kind of restored to what feels like a more organic process.
It's hard not to talk about the COVID pandemic crisis. And often what happens in crises is that they accelerate cultural change. So technology has often stepped in to do that. And we've seen digital stages like TikTok or YouTube as forums, as fora for everybody to share music. As I say, it's no longer necessarily in the hands of musicians, because anybody can do a parody on YouTube. So that's one possibility, that in a strange way, technology takes us back a million years to how music used to be. And that's a very optimistic development. But you don't need technology. In Britain, we had this weekly ritual last year where every Thursday evening, everybody and millions of people did clapped on their doorstep for the National Health Service, the NHS, in solidarity for the doctors and nurses. And this act of communal clapping, this was music, actually, as it used to be. It was also self-medicalizing or self-medicating, because the activity of playing together, of sharing music at a very fundamental level, made you feel better. So the irony was, whilst you were clapping for the health service, you were also self-medicating by doing that.
That's a beautiful story. I remember reading and seeing clips of that. And just to pick up on something you said a moment ago, which is, it's interesting, I think, how electronic music is kind of democratizing music in some way. It's making it accessible. I mean, these days, you have teenagers in their basements on their laptops creating incredible music and collaborating with people across the world. I mean, it's in many ways very freeing, and it's amazing to watch it, how that's progressing.
It is. We're a single planet, and the story which began with you know, sapiens taking the first steps out of Africa ends where music is circling the whole globe. It's total. If you look at the downloads for Gangnam Style, several billion people have watched it on YouTube. That's incredible. And it's very exciting that I've watched live streamed concerts happening during lockdown. Also, people singing together using the latest technology. It's always quite hard to synchronize simultaneous performances, but it's happening now, and it brings people together.
Mm-hmm. You've also written and talked about the importance of different musical collaborations that bring together different elements or styles. For example, a lot of people loved Hamilton, the theater production, and how it was able to interweave elements of rap music and other types. What's the importance of those, do you think?
The musical human, music is very close to creativity, and creativity is very close to human nature. What we are creative beings. And I think that music is very close to the wellsprings of creativity, because music naturally plays. In taking sound away from function, is playing with sound. If you look at the South German caves 40,000 years ago, the bone flute was found very close to the famous Lion Man figurine. It's a statue of a human with a lion's head. So playfulness means integrating diverse things together, throwing things together. And what a bone flute is, it's taking the bone from a vulture and turning it into a musical instrument. Mm-hmm. You're synthesizing, you're integrating, you're playing with things. What Hamilton does, like all music genres, it's fusing musicals with hip hop, just as, you know, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony integrates a symphony with a chorus. It incorporates a choir into a symphony, and pop genres move so fast from day to day because they're constantly subdividing and proliferating into sub genres. You know, hip hop and grunge and gospel. Look at what Beyoncé is doing. Who can, you know, label all the fusions that Beyoncé, Lemonade, throws together? So I think music is particularly close to the wellsprings of creativity in being a very natural mental playground or mental laboratory. And I argue that this is where science evolved. The ability to play and to imagine completely unforeseen combinations of things, not to mention to imagine gods or the divine or things which are very far away, like happy hunting grounds pictured on cave walls with bisons and horses. You know, what the flute was doing by the cave painting was transporting the Ice Age sapiens 40,000 years ago to those happy hunting grounds. At the same time, by being carved from a vulture bone, it was giving you access to the bird goddess. So in some ways, well, in many ways, actually, to play the flute was to give you access to the divine, hence the original link between music and religion.
You know, one thing that has always jumped out to me about Indian music, you even see it, I think, in certain Celtic music as well, is this may sound like a small point, but I'd be very curious to get your thoughts on it, is the power of drones, of droning music, and one sustained note that can carry out through an entire tone, like you'll hear in Indian music, for example, the kind of grounding, rooting element of that, in the sense you used the word earlier, how it tunes us. That to me seems to like there is some natural kind of connective tissue there between music and divinity. I wonder if you've explored that all or you've thought much about it.
Well, yeah, the drone in Indian music comes from the divine syllable or and you can chant Om, and you can, you know, immerse yourself in this droning syllable. And this is the hum of the world, you could say. And it suspends time because nothing happens in this room. And the world evolves by introducing time or temporal division or meter or motion into this drone. But as long as you have that drone, then you're transcending time. Mm. And this is one reason why Indian music feels a lot more timeless than Western music does.
Yeah.
And you get that in minimalism, in American minimalist music by Terry Riley or Steve Reich. This interest in timelessness. It's one of the answers to the travails of modernity, to lose yourself by recapturing this timelessness. Drones also rhyme with the landscape. They're a very good way of expressing a vast expanse of the landscape. And if you look at a lot of so-called pastoral music, pastoral as in Beethoven's Sixth Symphony or a lot of folk music, which emanate from the landscape, they also use drones for similar reasons.
Hmm.
Nature. It's about nature.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground today, and I feel like I've also failed to ask you the simple question of for you, why is this journey, this you know, cosmological, or this story of human nature through music, why for you has this been such a lifelong passion of understanding this?
Well, to speak personally, music spoke to me from my very earliest memory, in a way which nothing else did. It gave, not being a religious person, it gave me that link to something incredibly meaningful. It gave me meaning in life, and I've never veered away from that. So writing the book was a way of sharing it, to share not just my passion, but my conviction that music is so incredibly important. As a music professor, I'm all too aware that members of the public can be intimidated by the perception that music is quite technical and forbidding. So music notation and harmony and counterpoint is quite difficult to crack. And that's always stopped the incredible, the interesting things which are going on inside music from getting out there. I had a story to tell and I wanted to share it by getting away from this technical aspect of music. So you won't find any music notation in my book, and very little reference to music theory. That's not important. The message of music's power and its role in human evolution is much more interesting than getting lost in music theory.
Well, I wonder if you have any final thoughts you'd want to share with us as we begin to close out our conversation. I know we've covered some beautiful things today, but anything else that you would want to leave our listeners with?
It would be to urge people to make time and space for music, not just when you're cooking or in the gym or in your car, but make time just to sit in your couch and listen to whatever you're into for 20 minutes a week, within a day, and really listen to it and reconnect with music.
Well, Michael Spitzer, I really appreciated this conversation from one music lover to the next. I've learned a lot today, and thank you for the time.
Thanks for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Michael Spitzer is a professor of music at Liverpool University in the UK and the author of The Musical Human, A History of Life on Earth. Still to come, music's relationship to the brain. That's ahead on Life Examined. Stay with us. I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. We just heard Michael Spitzer trace the history of music and rhythm. He suggests that we all need to take some time each week to really sit down and listen and reconnect with music. So could listening to music also enhance the way our brains function? Can music help with Parkinson's and depression? And what types of music have the most therapeutic impact? Joining us to explain the effects of music on brain function is David Silverzweig. He's a neurologist and chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the Stanley Cobb Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. David Silverzweig, welcome to Life Examined.
I'm happy to be here and speak with you.
You have a fascinating history in terms of psychiatry, neuroscience. I know you're a bit of a musician as well, but I wonder for you when this real passion and understanding how music impacts or plays a role in how the brain works, when did this interest develop for you?
Well, music always was a core activity and part of my identity. And I think in college, I studied philosophy and became very interested in the mind-brain issues and the nature of the relationship between brain activity and mental activity and eventually in health and disease. And throughout various aspects of our life, and of course, music is one of the domains that's really important and meaningful and emotional for so many people and civilizations or cultures, that I was intrigued and wanted to sort of integrate my interests and became interested in understanding more about the mechanisms by which music arises and how it affects the brain.
Yeah. So kind of amaze us here a little bit. I mean, how does music penetrate the brain? What's going on inside of us?
So there are many different elements of that. One most obvious, perhaps, or initial, is that music comes in through our ears and the auditory sphere, although we can also feel it, especially in terms of rhythm or very deep bass frequencies, literally in our body, the vibrations. But music comes through the auditory system and comes through evolutionarily older circuits and regions, if you will, and also up to higher order regions. And the sounds get deconstructed and then reconstructed by the brain and interpreted and integrated with emotion and other elements and affect us. And so really it's the concerted action of a number of different brain areas and processes in the auditory system. And for music that has words, auditory linguistic systems, that activates, if you will, these systems and can drive them and also can start to be integrated with, as I mentioned, emotion and even behavior, as well as memory and mood.
So when you see, say, somebody listening or playing music under an MRI or fMRI, it sounds to me that there's just a lot of activity that would show up on the screen.
Absolutely. And you make an important point in distinguishing between or mentioning both listening to music versus playing music oneself. Those are two different things. They're interrelated, but they are different systems. In one case, it's more you're more on the receptive side of the auditory stimuli, if you will, that unfold in time, over time in music, which is another element that's very cool and important to understand about it. And in the other case, it is systems by which you generate music, either music that is something that you've pre-rehearsed or overlearned, or improvisation. Each of these types of activities has different neural signatures, as you might expect. And the neural signatures also depart from what's called the default mode of the brain, or the resting state or idling state of the brain that normally one is in. And then you start to stimulate the brain with these different frequencies and rhythms and tones and progressions. And you start to see areas in the temporal lobe, superior and middle temporal lobe of our brain, on the sort of sides of our brain inside what we would say medial to the ears and in the head. And then there's interconnections from primary auditory areas that process the pitch or frequency of sounds to what we call auditory association areas in these gyri, in these regions and in these networks that pull out different meanings from the sound and make different associations with the sound, also connecting up with memory networks, including in the middle part of the temporal lobes, the areas such as the hippocampus, and emotional areas that are involved in what we call the limbic system deep in the brain, some phylogenetically older areas, and related to that, motivational areas and reward areas in the brain, like something we call the nucleus accumbens or the ventral striatum that's involved when we listen to music and have a pleasurable feeling. And then finally, the behavioral aspects, you know, when we feel like we want to move or dance, that connect up to the motor system and behavioral output, or when it's in the case of playing music, that are involved in the automatized and also learned and spontaneous production of motor movements, finger movements, mouth movements that might be involved in producing music and listening to other people as you do it and integrating all of that in real time.
And David, you know, I'm really interested by this question of music and memory, which is something you mentioned there, which is how music can evoke these incredible memories of our past and almost transport us back to these different times. Can you talk a little bit more about that connection?
Absolutely. Emotional memory is really interesting. And in a way, it's the combining of emotions and memory processes, emotional and memory processes, that makes us remember things more and makes memory traces stronger, for good reason, because if something is salient to us as an organism or any organism, then it's more important that we remember it, and so those memory processes are strengthened. We see this with olfaction, one of the most primitive senses, where a certain smell can bring you right back to your grandmother's house or, you know, something like that, or with music, where you hear a tune and it takes you right back to seventh grade, etc. And so these associations are fascinating and point to the importance of the connections in the brain, the study of which is now called connectomics, using brain imaging and other technologies that allow us to understand how these things like memories, emotions, sensory processes all come together in a way that's adaptive and can be quite important in our lives in health and disease.
Let's talk a little bit about the therapeutic aspect of music. This is something that you've been looking into. It could be used for people that are, you know, suffering from depression or other neurological conditions. How do we begin to apply this in a therapeutic way?
Yeah, I'm glad you said depression and other neurological conditions, because it helps to understand that depression, especially in its more severe forms, is a brain problem, and not just a psychological issue. The music has been demonstrated in studies to be helpful for patients or people suffering from depression, where it can lift spirits and help to modulate moods to some extent. In patients with Alzheimer's disease, where they may not be able to have a certain level of functioning or verbiage or understanding or memory, but when a tune comes on from a certain era in their lives, an older period perhaps, they can light up and get engaged, and it can activate them and connect them more. In patients with Parkinson's disease, where they have difficulty initiating movements, if you play music that is that has a certain rhythm to it, it can get them walking, if you will. In patients who have a stroke in the dominant or left often hemisphere, who may have difficulty with language, one of the striking things is you can start to sing Happy Birthday, and they'll sing along with you, even though they otherwise won't be able to produce other language and words, because of the way in which the right hemisphere and other surrounding areas in the brain get recruited, and the ways in which these overlearned and musically associated tunes are represented in the brain. So there are a number of different areas where it can be helpful.
It's amazing to think that somehow music can pierce through what could be this, you know, this mental illness or something that, like Alzheimer's, blocks the recalling of memory. I mean, it shows that there's a certain kind of potency to the music that's kind of extraordinary.
Yes, a potency, and then as you unify all these things, it starts to make sense, because music has its effect, as we've been talking about, through the brain. That's how it's mediated. And these are disorders of the brain. And so it would stand to reason that that music can modulate brain activity, and in certain settings, though not curative, can be very helpful, at least for compensating or diverting, or in some cases, enhancing function.
I know that you're a trombonist, you're a percussionist, a guitarist. In thinking about rhythm here, or drums, something that we see, I think, fairly cross-culturally, how do you see rhythm impacting the brain, or the importance of someone engaging with it?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, the brain processes information via rhythms. One of the exciting areas right now is to really understand the temporal dynamics, the time signatures and oscillations that occur in the brain that bind across regions of the brain and synchronize in time certain processing. And that underlies many important aspects of consciousness, of awareness, and experience. And so, in a way, rhythm is a direct way of driving or pacing the brain and affecting the brain in those regards. And so there's research as to the differential effects of different rhythms, different tempos, and so forth. And again, they're cultural elements. One of my best friends and a former bandmate is a master West African drummer. And in that culture, of course, drumming is even more highly developed than it is in many other cultures, including in the United States, typically. And the complexity of the effects of the rhythms and their interactions is really something to behold, and the effect that can have on a group of people socially and emotionally, and in terms of the cohesion as well, is something that's currently being explored.
Tell me a little bit about where you think some of this research is going. What other exciting things do you see coming down the pipeline in terms of understanding music in the brain?
You know, one of the things that I think is really interesting is, in a way, sort of brain hacking that's going on already with things like Pandora and other algorithms that essentially, you know, take your own responses and selections and start zeroing in more and more on what you like and feeding it to you and reinforcing it and so forth. That's both a dangerous thing and a fascinating thing, and it can be a pleasurable thing. But I think that is something that that will provide a lot of data also, and we can understand more about the neural correlates, if not mechanisms of. And so try to understand the ways in which, as individuals, music modulates our brain, to be able to understand, as we know more now about the circuits underlying neuropsychiatric disorders, we can then marry those two streams of knowledge creation, if you will, and its experience, and be able to develop more individually tailored and disorder or symptom tailored approaches that are that are scientifically based, and yet, of course, you know, ultimately aesthetically pleasing and wonderful. And so it sort of transcends this distinction between the arts and the sciences.
Well, finally,
I mean, are you a proponent of listening to more music, learning to play more music, getting children involved in music? Just the more the better. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. You know, there's now strong evidence that music training does affect the brain. You can see structural and functional circuit changes in the brain. You can see volume changes in regions of the brain. You can see increased connectivity among certain regions of the brain. And so I think, you know, and people talk about the Mozart effect and this and that, and some of that's not supported and is overblown, but other aspects of that general notion and particular instantiations of that are certainly the case. And it's been shown now, you know, pretty consistently that music is good for the brain and that it generalizes beyond just the musical talent to be able to enhance other forms of executive functioning and cognition and emotion. And so I think the experience that many people have in different parts of the world and in educational systems would support that. And the more that can be developed and enhanced, the better. And as one thinks about funding for the arts and music programs and things like that, I think having this in mind when determining policy and resource allocations and so forth can be helpful.
David Silberzweig is a neurologist and chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the Stanley Cobb Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. David, thanks for joining us on Life Examined. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Take care.
Well, that's all for today. The producer of Life Examined is Andrea Brody. You can listen to this and all other episodes on your favorite podcasting app. And if you like what you hear, we'd love to read your review. You can also find us at kcrw.org/lifeexamined. I'm Jonathan Bastian. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.